And welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, July 28. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. The front page story of the Gazette for today, getting nickel refund may take longer trip. Grocers team up with recycler to keep empties away. Customers lugging empty cans and bottles back to grocery stores to reclaim deposits are finding in many cases they still can't refund empties there, even though an exemption for retailers ordered earlier in the coronavirus pandemic by the governor has expired. Fairway, for instance, announced its Iowa locations will not accept containers for redemption. Instead, its stores have posted lists of independent redemption centers close to each location. Its locations in Southwest Cedar Rapids and Marion have worked with the Can Shed Recycling Center to take the empties instead. Allowing used containers to be returned in our stores puts our employees and customers at risk and runs counterproductive to the many safety and sanitation initiatives we have implemented in order to keep people safe, the company announced. In the early days of the pandemic in Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds issued a sweeping emergency order March 17, closing or restricting businesses and gatherings. The proclamation also gave retailers a reprieve from taking back bottles and cans under Iowa's 1979 bottle bill. Grocers long have opposed the requirement as unsanitary and have tried so far without success to persuade lawmakers to change the law. But Reynolds' exemption expired Sunday, putting the bottle bill back into full effect. The only way a retailer was allowed to not take back bottles and cans for a refund was if it had an off-site redemption center approved by the Iowa DNR. The store must post a certificate issued by the state that identifies the redemption center, its location, and its hours. Getting those approvals is exactly what stores in the Can Shed have been doing in the corridor. The Can Shed said its four locations have been approved or expect to be approved by the state for a total of 17 retailers in the corridor. Hy-Vee Public Relations Director Christina Gaiman said its locations throughout the state will accept containers for redemption. However, its stores in Southwest Cedar Rapids, Marion, Hiawatha, and Iowa City have teamed up with the Can Shed to take the empties. Hy-Vee teamed up with Center Redemption in Dubuque. The supermarket chain obtained waivers from the Iowa DNR to work with the outside redemption centers, a process Gaiman said took several months. It's something we've been working on for several months in those markets to make sure that we follow the law so that we would be prepared when this restriction was lifted, she said. Troy Willard, owner and manager of the Can Shed, said the recycler has 1,500 to 1,800 people turning in containers among all its locations every day. The Cedar Rapids and Iowa City locations closed in mid-March and slowly began opening in mid-May. The Marion location opened permanently July 2, and the newest shop in Hiawatha opened Monday. All locations are open 6 days a week and accept aluminum cans and plastic and glass bottles with an Iowa refund stamp. Each partnership will last at least a year, Willard said, with the hopes of continuing. Time will tell, Willard said. We'll see how it works out for the both of us and go forward from there. While working with a redemption center might bring relief to grocery stores, it doesn't necessarily make things easier for people trying to bring their cans and bottles in. Marion resident Ron Williams began taking containers to the Marion Can Shed when it opened, but found the process lengthy and confusing compared with what he did at the store. Can Shed locations in Cedar Rapids, Marion, and Hiawatha have installed reverse vending machines like those at stores, but Williams said it was too busy. I stow them in the back of the car and drive by every once in a while to see if I can get in line, but I haven't been able to do that yet, Williams said. Willard said the company has tried to merge the process seen at grocery stores and its own processes that include bulk returns to make things easier. We've been trying to be very interactive with our customers as they are coming in, explaining all their options to them so they can pick their experience going forward a little bit better each time, Willard said. Also on the front page, the airport to require masks starting today. The Eastern Iowa Airport will require anyone in its terminal to wear face coverings starting today, the Airport Commission decided unanimously Monday morning. There are exemptions for passengers younger than age 2 because of possible suffocation. Other passengers with medical conditions that prevent them from wearing face coverings, and for anyone eating or drinking. It's about trying to get people more comfortable to travel again, Airport Director Marty Lenz told the Gazette. The airport previously required its employees to wear masks, but airport vendors did not need to do so. Now vendors, too, will have to wear masks while in any public part of the terminal. Anybody doing business in the terminal or coming into the terminal's public areas will have to wear a mask, Lenz said. A passenger can obtain a mask at the airport in Cedar Rapids for no cost if they do not have one. Lenz said the airport received about 65,000 masks from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We've got both cloth face masks as well as the lighter paper face masks, Lenz said. The airport's public safety officers and guest services staff will enforce the mask mandate, he said. If someone is not wearing a mask and is not a ticketed passenger, that person will be asked to leave the terminal. A public safety officer will remind unmasked ticketed passengers of airlines' mask requirements. They have to wear one on the airplane regardless, or they can't fly, Lenz said. Lenz said the goal was to enforce this certainly without fines. Many other airports in the Midwest already have similar mask requirements, including O'Hare International in Chicago and Mitchell International in Milwaukee. Des Moines International does not have a mask mandate, but passengers are strongly encouraged to wear a mask. Guidance from the U.S. Department of Transportation, Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Homeland Security, released July 2, said airports and airlines should require face coverings among 10 other safety measures. The commission at Monday's meeting also unanimously approved mandatory health screenings for all passengers. The measure saw broad support at a public comment hearing earlier in July. No one disagreed with the health screening measures, and one person was arguing for more precautions. It will include a two-step health screening. If a passenger passes the first phase, airport and healthcare officials anticipate that takes about 10 seconds, without any problems, they can proceed to the Transportation Security Administration checkpoint. There will be a more thorough screening for anyone who does not pass the primary temperature check, including a health assessment to see whether there's another reason for the high temperature. Assuming the airport receives financial support from the FAA, Lenz expects the health screenings to begin in the first or second week of September. After passenger traffic was down 97% year-to-year in April and 88% in May, passenger traffic was down 78% in June. The passenger totals in June were the highest since March, but are far from what the airport's typical busy season would look like. The numbers have been inching upwards, Lenz said. It's certainly headed in the right direction. Much of that increase comes from leisure travel during the summer. Allegiant Air, which markets itself towards vacation travelers, saw passenger numbers down only 58% in June. Lenz said a good chunk of that will go away soon, though, with families holding off on vacations when children are in school. You traditionally see a slowdown in leisure traffic, Lenz said. Allegiant certainly adjusts to that factor. Other airlines' passenger totals were down 64% to 94%. Delta Airlines, which had 17,218 enplaned passengers at the Eastern Iowa Airport in June 2019, had 980 this June. Delta will resume service Saturday to Detroit and Atlanta, so Lenz expects the Delta passenger totals to pick up a little bit in the next few weeks. But it's still not an easy path forward for the airport. Business traffic has always been the constant. And nationally, we just don't have the same business traffic levels back that we need to see, Lenz said. We can't continue to run the business down 70%. Moving to the Iowa Today page, judge sides with Cedar Rapids in lawsuit that challenges Cargill's rail yard. Project stays in limbo pending a decision on separate rezoning case. Contentious plans for Cargill, a major Cedar Rapids employer, to build a $6.5 million rail yard in the Rompott neighborhood remains in limbo. A judge ruled in one lawsuit filed against the city that the city council's vote to change the future land use map was supported by evidence, but a related case remains in litigation. Sixth District Court Judge Mary Cicelli ruled Friday in favor of the city and Cargill, but in her ruling said the court will not substitute its judgment as to the wisdom or propriety of the defendant's action when the reasonableness of the future land use map is fairly debatable, as shown by discussions surrounding the plaintiff's contention. State Senator Ron Hogg of Cedar Rapids, who, along with his wife Catherine, filed two lawsuits in December against the city to challenge the council's vote on the future land use map and rezoning, contended the decisions conflicted with the city flood protection plan, greenway plan, designation of the land as a prairie pollinator zone, and part of the Sac and Fox Nature Way, and also violates residents' property rights. Hogg said he plans to appeal within the state's 30-day deadline. "I think the decision is wrong, both factually and legally," Hogg said. A judge has not yet ruled in a separate lawsuit filed in December on rezoning, which Dan Polis, Cedar Rapids Corn Processing Facility Manager, said in a statement Monday that Cargill's officials are waiting on to move forward. "We are pleased that the Iowa District Court for Linn County has ruled in favor of the City of Cedar Rapids and its decision to amend the future land use map of the Stewart parcel for development of the Cargill Rail Yard," Polis said. Ken DeKaiser, City Development Services Manager, said that to move the project forward, Cargill must finalize steps in the development agreement, including appraisal and purchase of the property, providing construction plans, and completing public outreach. The city's approval in December on rezoning and amending the future land use map gave Cargill the green light to build a 12-track, 200-car rail yard, despite vocal opposition from some Cedar Rapids residents. The project will be on 28 acres of city-owned land south of Stewart Road, southeast, between the blue-collar Rompott neighborhood and Prairie Park Fishery. Construction required rezoning the land to industrial use and a change to the city's future land use map. Cargill officials said the rail yard is needed for more supply chain stability and to protect jobs at the corn milling plant at 1710 16th Street Southeast, not far from the rail yard site. Cargill officials plan to submit final paperwork within a month of the vote, begins construction in early spring, and have the rail yard operating by the end of the year. Plaintiffs argue that the Stewart Road property is within a 200-year floodplain and should not be sold. They also contend the city's decision violates the flood protection provisions of the city's Envision CR comprehensive plan to embrace the natural systems and support the riverfront greenway. But the judge, in ruling on the future land use map, found nothing in the council's vote was, quote, unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious, or lacking substantial evidence in the record, end quote. In another Iowa Today story, the IC gift to the University of Iowa would help write a new chapter for historic home. Iowa City is hoping to give, at no cost, the University of Iowa a $1 million sliver of property in exchange for a campus commitment to use the land to save the community's oldest known house. Per the deal, which the State Board of Regents will consider Wednesday, the city will give UI the 0.2-acre parcel in the 100 block of Market Street, which it's using as a parking lot. In exchange, the UI would commit to relocate the 177-year-old Sanye Gilmore House from across the street. The university would be responsible for all costs associated with moving this two-story Greek Revival house and renovating it for use as its new UI nonfiction writing program. That program is housed now in the English Philosophy Building. UI officials did not respond to questions Monday about how much they expect to spend on the project. A city assessment of costs put the total at more than $1.23 million. The property transfer, quote, would help establish a riding neighborhood along Clinton Street, end quote, according to a UI proposal, highlighting two other renovated homes along Clinton Street that today house UI riding programs, the Day House, home to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and the Shambaugh House, home to Iowa's International Writing Program. Officials said they plan to cover the massive moving and renovating expense with a substantial gift. The university did not provide the Gazette with details of that gift or a timeline for the relocation. The university had planned to demolish the home at 109 East Market Street after buying it and another connected property from Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Iowa City in 2018 for $2.7 million. By adding to its property portfolio that prime real estate across from the UI Papa John Business Building, campus officials initially aired plans to develop and construct a new academic building, potentially an entrepreneurial center associated with the Tippey College of Business. In hopes of saving the historic house, the city worked with the UI on relocation, identifying 10 possible sites. Making it less complicated than other options, including Mercy Iowa City parking lots and property owned by Ace Hardware, is the Sanier Gilmore's proximity to the city parking lot, affording the shortest move possible. Within the same block as the original, this site would be the best choice for maintaining National Register eligibility and mitigating moving costs, according to city documents. The Iowa City Historic Preservation Commission and the City Council approved the property transfer, without which would have left Iowa City with a hefty tab to save the historic home. The house was built in 1843 and is associated with the Sanyers, considered a founding family in Iowa City. Recent research revealed that the construction of the house occurred at the same time that the Capitol building was being built, affirming the fact that it is one of the oldest structures in Iowa City, according to city documents. Gloria Day originally proposed moving the house on its own dime to a nearby courtyard in a different historic district, but it backed off that plan in response to concerns the relocation would undermine the historic integrity of both the house and the historic district, according to the city. Per the agreement, to transfer the 2B Sanier Gilmore site from the city to the Board of Regents, the UI will be responsible for maintaining and preserving the home for at least 40 years. If the UI no longer has use for the home within the 40-year period, ownership will revert to the city, according to the agreement. Also in the Iowa Today section, Lynn Supervisor's mole mandate for masks might enlist mayors. The Lynn County Board of Supervisors is considering issuing a proclamation to require face masks within the county and might be asking mayors to sign on. The discussion of a proclamation brought to the table Monday during a work session by Supervisor Ben Rogers was centered on the logistics of enforcement and legality. "We're getting a lot of questions as to what we can and cannot do," Rogers said. Lisa Epp of the Lynn County Attorney's Office answered supervisors' questions during the meeting. "Anything the board does covers unincorporated Lynn County," she said. "Lynn County can do a proclamation if they would like," Epp said. "It can only cover unincorporated areas. The proclamation can be made, but there's no way to have any penalty or enforcement in a proclamation or resolution." Epp said cities have a slighter edge on being able to include enforcement within proclamations or resolutions. Supervisor Brent Olison proposed calling a joint meeting with the supervisors and Lynn County Board of Health and inviting various mayors to sign on as supporters of a resolution encouraging private businesses and other entities where people congregate to require face masks. "I think it would have some power with different leaders saying the same thing," Olison said. Last week, Johnson County followed Iowa City in passing its own face mask mandate, requiring coverings in public spaces. The county also acknowledged that its mandate is not enforceable. Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague issued a proclamation regarding face masks, contending he could do so because of emergency powers granted to mayors under Iowa code. Teague has been the only mayor, aside from Muscatine Mayor Diana Broderson, to issue a mask mandate. Governor Kim Reynolds has not issued a requirement for masks, though during her news conference she has encouraged Iowans to wear them. Reynolds said the mayor's mask mandates were in conflict with her statewide COVID-19 emergency proclamation and therefore were invalid. Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker said he has been frustrated with the lack of action and said the Board of Health has authorized Linn County's public health director to send a note to Reynolds imploring her to issue a comprehensive mask mandate or grant local jurisdiction for authorities to do so. I agree with Supervisor Olison that these appeals to our governor will be strengthened if we can have several localities on board with the same message, Walker said. As the discussion ended, the three supervisors decided the board should move on issuing a proclamation this week. The board will hold its former meeting at 11 a.m. Wednesday. Moving to the Insight page, the guest column today is from Joe Locke. Joe is the president and CEO of Eastern Iowa Health Center. Work for healthy communities. Rooted in the civil rights movement, community health centers, known as CHCs, have responded to the unique needs of the communities they serve for the past 55 years. As healthcare providers to more than 30 million Americans and 226,000 Iowans, health centers provide comprehensive, culturally sensitive services to all. In the midst of a public health crisis in our national dialogue around equity, National Health Center Week, August 9 to 15, is the perfect time to recognize that CHCs contribute to the nation's healthcare system. CHCs are the preeminent safety net provider offering care to veterans, the homeless, and children in both rural and urban areas. Cedar Rapids CHC, Eastern Iowa Health Center, treated more than 13,500 patients in 56,095 provider-patient visits in 2019 across our three delivery sites, providing integrated medical, pediatric, behavioral health, dental, OBGYN, and social supports. CHCs are economic drivers, having a $35.5 million annual economic impact in Iowa. Not only do we provide job opportunities in our communities, but we help keep the local workforce healthy and productive. During COVID-19, CHCs are an important piece of our community's response as we provide not only safe access to health care, but also are helping to mitigate the spread by providing testing and treatment for the virus. CHCs have responded to COVID-19 by increasing the use of telehealth and telemedicine, offering COVID-19 drive-up testing, and maintaining care for their regular patients. However, we need Congress's support in order to survive this pandemic. In the short term, we need additional emergency funds to support our response, infrastructure resources to allow us to expand our physical space to allow for social distancing and patient safety, and a permanent fix to allow us to bill Medicare for telehealth services. Additionally, federal funding for CHCs and critical workforce programs are set to expire November 30. If that funding lapses, CHCs will have to make drastic cuts to services, delivery locations, and staff. We implore Congress to continue to support our work. The health of our communities depends on it. And again, that guest column is by Joe Locke, President and CEO of Eastern Iowa Health Center. We have one community letter today. Remember to donate money if you can. This by Wendy Hartman in Cedar Rapids. Politics aside, I hope there is a surge in charitable donations once the stimulus checks are sent out by the federal government. Your tax dollars hard at work. A person may need the money to pay bills, buy groceries, or make a rent payment due to furloughs or layoffs. But others, even those considered low or middle income, may not. Consider giving some, any or all, to an organization that can use the money to help others. Many local and national charities come to mind, including churches and community groups such as Olivet Mission, Willis-Dady Homeless Shelter, or excuse me, Homeless Services, Aid to Women, Feed Iowa First, and Cedar Valley Humane Society. However, a family may need the money to survive. May we use our taxes wisely. I do find it strangely unnerving that the federal government is putting money directly into my bank account, whether I want, need, or deserve it. The government giveth, and certainly the government can taketh away. I now understand the movie line, "We don't want no charity," and the old-timey concept of being beholden. But there are legitimate nonprofit charities in need that can do exponential good with your donation. Please consider a gift today. And again, that is from Wendy Hartman in Cedar Rapids. And the At Liberty column today by Adam Sullivan, it's obvious that blue lives matter. A few hundred people gathered in Marion this past weekend to proclaim the obvious. Police lives matter. The Back the Blue / Back the Green rally was staged in support of police, first responders, and military veterans. It was a response to recent protests against racism and police violence, which have drawn thousands of activists to the streets in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and Des Moines. Attendees at Marion Square Park hoisted American flags and signs with slogans such as "Blue Lives Matter." The rally organizer said he was surprised at how many people showed up. He told a Gazette News reporter, "To be serious, I was shocked. I was like, wow, there are people in Iowa who support police officers. That's amazing. I was not surprised at all to see that a few hundred fellow Iowans support police. Despite recent mass protests, law enforcement remains one of the most highly respected professions in the country. We know that blue lives matter because when police officers are killed in the line of duty, there is an overwhelming community-wide response. The law enforcement and criminal justice systems quickly mobilize to apprehend and punish the offender, while regular people show their support through memorial donations and support ribbons. When two Des Moines area police officers were killed in ambush shootings in 2016, the lone shooter was captured within 12 hours, later pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder, and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Thousands of people attended the funerals for Justin Martin of the Urbandale Police Department and Anthony Baminio of the Des Moines Police Department. The president, the governor, and the U.S. Attorney General all condemned the killings. No prosecution, memorial, or statement from a politician is adequate to honor the lives of public servants who give their lives while serving the public, but it's obvious that their lives matter to Iowans and to millions of other Americans. Many Iowans have been disturbed to see anti-police graffiti sprayed on streets and buildings by protesters in Iowa City, including pigs with X's over their eyes, meant to depict dead police officers. However, calls to incite physical violence against cops are not representative of the majority of Black Lives Matter protesters, and certainly not a majority of Iowans. In an annual poll of Americans' confidence in U.S. institutions, police are one of the only sectors consistently earning majority support. They only trailed the military and small business in Gallup's 2019 survey. In light of current events and the mass movement to reform law enforcement, many Americans are rethinking their opinions. Most are taking nuanced positions rather than coming out against the police. About 3/4 of Americans support recent protests, and about half say the police response to protests has been appropriate, according to a Washington Post poll last month. More than 2/3 of Americans say they trust their local police in an Axios poll last month. Iowans back the blue, but we also demand policy changes that will reduce violence and racial disparities. We don't have to pick one or the other. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, July 28, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices or other notices from Anamosa, Margaret Pilcher, age 96, died Sunday, July 26. The Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa is in charge. In Cedar Rapids, Mary Anna Szabo, age 82, died Monday, July 27. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Robin Ann Young, age 58, died Monday, July 27. From Earlville, Richard Conrad, age 73, died Sunday, July 26. The Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Earlville is in charge. In Maquoketa, Berna L. Sagers, age 83, died Saturday, July 25. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Postville, Betty Jean Doze Frey, age 89, died Friday, July 24th. The Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Postville is in charge. Also from Postville, Keith Rothman, age 81, died Sunday, July 26th. Again, the Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Postville. From Strawberry Point, Ivanelle Leona Bushaw, age 89, died Sunday, July 26. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Strawberry Point. And in other deaths, Hazel L. Wachter Ellis, age 100, of Patch Grove and Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, died Sunday, July 26. The Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Prairie du Chien is in charge. And moving to the longer notices, from Cedar Rapids, Janet Ann Murray Blassengame, age 76, died Saturday, July 25. A funeral mass will be held at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family with arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, Lillian Alice Springman, age 90, passed away Thursday, July 23rd at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House. As per Lily's wishes, private family services will be held. The Brosh Chapel and the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge of arrangements. Also from Cedar Rapids, Donna Dorothy Smith, age 95, died Friday, July 24th at home, surrounded by family. Private family services will be held on Thursday, July 30th at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Public visitation will be on Thursday, July 30th from 1 to 2 at the Cedar Memorial Chapel. The private family service will be live streamed on Thursday at 2 p.m. and may be viewed online. As mandated by proclamation, social distancing must be practiced, which requires a limited number of people allowed at the visitation at one time. The use of face masks or shields is encouraged. CedarMemorial.com is in charge of arrangements and is where you can view the service online. From Kansas City, Missouri, Mary Catherine Harrison Kastek, age 93 of Kansas City, formerly of Dowling, Iowa, died Thursday, July 23rd. Graveside services will be held Thursday, July 30th at 1 p.m. at the Anderson Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Cascade, Kenneth John McDermott, age 77, passed away on Saturday, July 25 at his home in Cascade. Visitation for Kenneth will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, July 28, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade. Social distancing will be followed as recommended. Face masks are required to attend. Anyone interested in sending memorials may send them to the Reef Funeral Home in Cascade. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30, Wednesday, July 29, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, with the Reverend Douglas Locke presiding and the Reverend Mark Osterhaus concelebrating. Burial will be held in Calvary Cemetery in Cascade with full military honors. From Center Point, Lucille Agnes Williams, age 99, died Saturday, July 25th. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 30th at Center Point United Methodist Worship Center in Center Point. Funeral service is at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at the Center Point United Methodist Worship Center and burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family with arrangements. And lastly, from Phoenix, Arizona, Dennis L. Schmickel, age 74, of Phoenix, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, July 25, after a long battle with cancer. There will be no visitation or services at this time. In honor of Dennis, memorials can be made to the American Cancer Society. One obituary to add is from the Iowa City Press Citizen. From Iowa City, Joseph S. Proud, age 52, passed away Monday, July 20th at the University of Iowa Hospitals. A gathering of family and friends will take place from 11 to 12:30 on Friday, July 31, at the Pape Funeral Home. A memorial service will begin at 12:30 following, and burial will be at the Oakland Cemetery. Lots of high school sports to report today, so I may include these in abbreviated form. From state baseball, North Lynn walks it off at state. They were the ones North Lynn wanted up with the game online. The fiery leader and resilient senior were the ones they needed after four freshmen fought to give them one more chance to extend the season. Austin Hilmer and Parker Bacon delivered back-to-back singles to score the tying and winning runs for number two North Lynn's 2-1 come-from-behind thriller over seventh-seeded Durant in the Class 2A state baseball quarterfinal last night at Principal Park. The Lynx, with a record of 19-2, reached their third straight semifinal in their fifth trip of the last six seasons. "This is my favorite game by far," Hilmer said. "Obviously, my role was a little bit bigger this year. To step up and get a big hit, I'm glad I got the opportunity. I'm so proud of these guys. I don't think I've ever had a walk-off here at state in the last 3 years." And also, from the front page, bombs away in state softball. Kennedy blasts three homers, then holds on to advance. Kaylin Kinney's remarkable shutout streak has come to an end, but the only streak that really matters, that one's alive and well. Second-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy struck for three early home runs, then after things got tight, the Cougars tallied six times in the bottom of the sixth inning and topped number 9 Pleasant Valley 10-4 in a Class 5A quarterfinal at the state softball tournament Monday at Rogers Sports Complex. "That was a huge boost," Kinney said. "We knew we had to put more runs on the board." The Cougars, with a record of 24-1, won their 17th consecutive game and advanced to face number 8 Muscatine, also with a record of 19-2, in a semifinal, 11 a.m. Wednesday on Kruger Field. The Muskies tripped number 3 West Des Moines Valley, the defending champion, by a 3-1 verdict. It was a much happier first-round experience than last year, when the Cougars were drubbed by Iowa City High. "Like I said before we left, if we were going to make the trip, we've got to make it a memorable one," Kennedy coach Madison LeClaire said. "It's one at a time, win and move on." Kinney hit a solo home run, a bomb to center field of about 250 feet, in the bottom of the first inning. Keaton Gerber added a laser to right in the second, and Maya Dodge poked a two-run shot in the third to make it 4-0. "The team really backs me up and it helped me focus," Gerber said. "When I'm focused, I hit the ball well." Dodge said, "We laid off the rise balls. We were looking down and inside, and we were just attacking." Kinney, 10-0, entered the game with a 51-inning scoreless streak, and it reached 54 1/3 before Pleasant Valley snapped it with a run in the fourth. The Spartans scored two more in the sixth to get within 4-3. "It wasn't my best game, but I was able to stay calm and trust the process," said Kinney, whose ERA climbed to a still minuscule 0.37. The Cougars went back to work offensively, taking advantage of three sixth-inning walks. The third, coaxed by Alyssa Martin on a full count, drove in an insurance run. Then Kinney singled home two runs. Dodge doubled in another, and Abby Spohr plated two more with a single. That made it 10-3, and the Cougars were set. "We wanted to get it back on offense and put a crooked number up there," LeClaire said. A University of Nebraska signee, Kinney was 3-4, raising her season batting average to .625. Dodge matched her with three RBIs. In Class 4A, Winterset tops West Delaware 7-4. The Hawks rally for 3 runs in the 7th inning but can't extend with a streak. According to Jenna Young, the Winterset Huskies hit better against better pitchers, and Macy Kleitch is a very good one. "We knew we had to come out swinging and get ahead," Young said. "Consider it done." Number 10 Winterset pounded out 11 hits in the first 3 innings, held off a late charge, and knocked off number 2 West Delaware 7-4 in a Class 4A quarterfinal at the state softball tournament Monday at Rogers Sports Complex. "Hats off to them," West Delaware coach Tiffany Rave said. "They were ready to go. They picked out some good pitches and hit them hard." Kleitch said they definitely had a good hit, had good hitters. They hit some gaps, and it seemed we hit it right at them. Winterset, with the record of 15-7, scored all 7 of its runs in the first 3 innings, including 5 in the second, and advanced to face number 8 Dallas Center Grimes with a record of 20-9 in a semifinal at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesday. And in Class 2A, it's a rough day for Mid Prairie. Walks, hit batsman error allow West Lyon to build a large lead. Mid Prairie's early struggles resulted in 1 big inning. It also created a deficit too big to overcome. The 4th-seeded Golden Hawks suffered some early pitching woes that allowed West Lyon to score 5 runs and send 11 batters to the plate without a hit in the second inning, and the Wildcats rolled to a 13-3 victory in 6 innings in Class 2A state baseball quarterfinal Monday at Principal Park. "We got off to a rough start on the mound," Mid Prairie coach Andy Greiner said. "I feel like you get off to a start like that, it makes it even more difficult as the game progresses. I feel like it snowballed on us." The Wildcats took control with the big inning that opened with 2 hit batters, followed by an error on a sacrifice bunt to load the bases. Zach Van Beek drew the first of 4 bases loaded walks in the inning. Josh Van Beek, Easton freshman, and Easton Fleshman and Jalen Gramstead also earned run-scoring walks. Gavin Lorenzen added a sacrifice fly. West Lyon increased its lead with 4 in the third, getting a 3-run double from Josh Van Beek. Jackson Kramer's 2-run triple in the fourth put the Wildcats up 11-0. And here's state softball at a glance, a closer look at the area teams that are playing today in Fort Dodge. In Class 3A, number 3 Williamsburg, with a record of 23-4, is playing the Raiders. The Raiders face number 6 Algona, with a record of 16-1, at 1 p.m. In Class 2A, number 1 North Lynn, with a record of 23-0, face Ridgeview with a record of 11-8. That game's at 11 a.m. And in Class 1A, number 8 Lisbon with a record of 20-3 will face number 2 Newell Fonda with a record of 18-2. And that game is today at 7 p.m. In a Class 3A preview, rocky start didn't bother Marion. It wasn't a matter of if, but when and whether there was enough time. Marion coach Steve Fish recognized the potential. He also realized the players needed some time to grow into a team that could return to the state baseball tournament. The question Fish had were answered last week when the Indians dropped third-ranked and 2019 state runner-up DeWitt Central for a third state berth in the last 4 seasons. "Everything had to be done quickly," said Fish in his 21st season as head coach. "That was my concern. I would tell people, give us 2 or 3 more weeks and this group will be even more competitive. Normally you have enough time, but everybody is in the same boat." Marion hit its stride late and faced top-seeded Sergeant Bluff Luton today in the Class 3A state quarterfinals at Principal Park, and that game is set to begin at 1:30. The Indians, 10-0, are 1 of 3 WOMAC Conference programs in the field, joining 5th-seeded Clear Creek Amana with a record of 16-5 and number 7 seed Benton Community with a record of 13-11. Benton community, with a record of 13-11, posted a come-from-behind victory over another WOMAC program, South Tama, to notch its first state berth since 2012. Benton takes on second-seeded and fourth-ranked Dallas Center Grimes at 4:30. I've always said the WOMAC Conference is one of the best baseball conferences in the state, Fish said. It's good baseball. Moving to a couple short stories on the Business 380 page, Target says no to in-store shopping this Thanksgiving. Target is joining Walmart in closing its stores Thanksgiving Day. That decision will end a decade-long tradition of jump-starting Black Friday doorbuster sales. The move announced Monday comes as stores are rethinking this year's Black Friday shopping bonanza, along with other key retail days during the holiday season as the country battles the coronavirus pandemic. Stores always depended on big holiday crowds and work as much as a year in advance with manufacturers on Now the virus has turned holiday shopping models upside down. Stores have slashed orders and crowds are an anathema. With fears of a wave of virus cases in the fall, the biggest nightmare would be if retailers had to reclose during the most critical. Historically, deal hunting and holiday shopping can mean crowded events, and this isn't a year for crowds, Minneapolis-based Target said in a corporate blog posted. It said its holiday deals would come earlier than ever, starting in October. Bentonville, Arkansas-based Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, announced its move last week. Walmart and Target declined to comment on their plans for Black Friday, but analysts say they are convinced that the retailers will pivot their business more online and focus on limiting the number of shoppers in stores. Macy's CEO Jeff Gennett said earlier this month that the department store will be pivoting its Black Friday business more towards online and probably will be going full force with holiday marketing right after Halloween. Macy's will be staggering events to reduce customer traffic in its stores. And in another Business 380 article, Google employees to keep working from home until summer 2021. Google won't bring its 200,000 employees back to the office until July 2021, pushing past its January timeline as coronavirus cases surge across the country and a vaccine remains months away. That makes the parent company, Alphabet, the first major U.S. company to push its office comeback into the second half of next year. The move illustrates how corporate America is writing its own guidebook for managing the social, economic, and public health byproducts of the pandemic. From enforcing face mask mandates to retaining employees to mitigating the safety risks for consumers and staff. But each decision, contingent on the nation's return to normalcy or what passes for it now, is tentative. Chief Executive Sundar Pichai announced the new timetable in a company-wide email to give employees the ability to plan ahead. Pichai was partly influenced by the differing approaches to schools reopening across the country, the Wall Street Journal reported. The work-from-home option applies to 200,000 full-time and contract employees attached to the company's headquarters in Mountain View, California, as well as offices in other parts of the United States, the UK, and India. Google's move could motivate other corporations to reevaluate their timelines, especially as the numbers of confirmed novel coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to rise. Last week, 1.4 million Americans filed new jobless claims, the highest number since March. Moving to the community page, there are a couple of Eastern Iowa briefs of note. Iowa City Public Art Advisory Committee awards money to public arts projects. The Iowa City Public Art Advisory Committee has announced awards totaling $7,000 for four public art projects through its matching grant program, which matches funds of up to $2,000 for visual, audio, or performance-based art. Proposals are submitted by artists and members of the PAAC make final award selections. The program, which began in 2015, has provided more than $25,000 for local arts opportunities. Additional money is available through the matching grant program. Artists interested must apply by 5 p.m. August 21st. Find the application form online at the iowacitygov.org website. among the most recently approved projects, Wild Prairie Winds Music in the Park Concert Series. The Wild Prairie Winds, a professional wind quintet, will perform four chamber music concerts in various city parks to promote environmental awareness in the Midwest. Concerts will be scheduled for next spring, and updates will be provided on the wildprairiewinds.com website. Next is Bloomington Street Head Start HACAP, or HACAP, mural project. Iowa City artists Thomas Agron and Sayuri Sasaki Heyman will create a mural on the west-facing wall of the building at 318 East Bloomington Street, featuring colors and designs inspired by the children who participate in the Head Start program in that building. The mural is set to be completed in September. Also, Sprites. Jason Snell, a multidisciplinary artist, will install a motion sensor system that detects pedestrian traffic in the alley between South Dubuque and South Lynn and Washington Streets and Iowa Avenue. The motion will trigger a lighting response as if a sprite entity is coming to welcome the visitor. The installation will complement a permanent art exhibit in the alley created by the Iowa City Downtown District and Slingshot Architecture. And finally, Open Air Media Festival. Public Space One Media Arts Co-op will create a video art projection performance in several locations throughout Iowa City. The series will activate spaces not usually inhabited with visual art in an effort to create a sense of surprise and safe accessibility for viewers. The next performance is expected to take place 9 to 11 p.m. August 15th. For updates and specific location information, go to publicspace1.com. And for more information on any of these projects, you may call Marcia Ballinger at 319-356-5237. And in Manchester, sign up for whitewater kayaking class planned for August at Manchester Course. Buchanan and Bremer County Conservation staff and Crawdaddy Outdoors of Waverly will be offering a whitewater kayaking class at the Manchester Whitewater Course at 10:30 a.m. August 17th. Cost is $40 per person, and there is a 10-person limit with a minimum age limit of 10 years old. The program includes use of kayaks, helmets, and life jackets, as well as a short training program on how to paddle and steer a kayak and navigate the course drops successfully. While outdoors on the river, social distancing will be easily maintained, but participants will be responsible for social distancing while on the course walkway and while waiting their turn to navigate at the top. Participants will also work with a partner to carry their kayak and equipment back along the walkway from the bottom of the rapids to the top. Each adult participant must sign a participant liability waiver and COVID-19 health statement for themselves and or their children. To register, go online at the BuchananCountyParks.com. That brings us to the end of today's reading for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Tuesday, July 28th. I'm your reader, Kathleen Jesperson. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.